Welcome. I'm Dr. Dawn Gross, and this is Dying to Talk, KALW's program dedicated to transforming the taboos around death and dying. National Healthcare Decisions Day is an annual initiative to inspire and educate the public about the importance of conversations about advanced care planning. This year, it's been expanded to a full week, and today, we're bringing this conversation into the community as we record this program with the live audience. Let's hear it, audience. In San Mateo, thanks to our hosts at Mission Hospice and Home Care. Before the show, we began the day by playing a game called Go Wish. It's all about discovering and talking about what matters most to us in life and at the end of life. And for those of you who are Dying to Talk listeners, you'll know I played this game live on the radio with my family in one of our first programs, and you can find that online if you're curious. This may never seem like a conversation you want to have until the moment you find yourself in a position where you wish you had had it. And that's what we're really going to be talking about today. Joining me are two people who know this experience intimately from two very different perspectives. Dr. Jessica Nudig-Zitter is a physician at Highland Hospital in Oakland, California, where she practices a rare combination of critical care medicine, that's medicine in the ICU, the intensive care unit, and palliative medicine. She's author of the book Extreme Measures and is featured in the Oscar-nominated short documentary Extremis. Dr. Zitter is at the leading edge of a movement to educate and empower people to forge a better path to the end of life. I'm also grateful to call her friend, colleague, and collaborator, and welcome her back to Dying to Talk. Jessica, thanks for joining us.
An incredible pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Also joining us is Gordon Kaufman. Now, for those of you who have not seen Extremis, consider this your spoiler alert. Gordon and his sister Donna are one of the central stories of the film. And we're truly, truly lucky to get to hear the continuation of this incredible story beyond where the film leaves off. Gordon, welcome to Dying to Talk.
Thank you. Blessed to be here.
So you both share a story that surrounds the end of Donna's life. I gave you the spoiler alert, yet from two very different perspectives. So I'd like to begin with each of you sharing how you first came to know each other.
My sister Donna and I had a unique relationship where I had opportunity to be a full-time caregiver for her for 5 years. She had a myotonic dystrophy, a form of muscular dystrophy, and we lost a sister prior to that. So we knew what we were up against. I was taking care of her. Things were going great. Had not even discussed hospice or what to do, but we had made a pact that she was going to get to die at home, like our family always liked to take care of each other. But unfortunately, she took a turn for the worse one day. Her legs were numb. I took her to Highland. She was part of the county healthcare system, and I just took her in to find out why her legs were numb. And unfortunately, after a couple days, she took a couple turns for the worse, and now we wound up in ICU. And actually, my sister was had already talked to Dr. Zitter and to a film director, Dan Krause, who did the film Extremis. And he says, you know, there's a doctor I'd like you to meet. Donna's already met her. And, you know, you're in the hospital like everybody else. And a doctor walks in, and her aura, everything about Dr. Zitter when she saw my sister, I just sat there, and in my mind was everything I've always wanted for my sister. Just seemed like it was coming true. Just there's a doctor that didn't look at her body frail and in the condition she was in. She didn't look at her that way. She was just energy, and she was uplifting. I was like, God, I hope this is going to be Donna's doctor. And as we had a chance to meet Dr. Zitter, and she says, I'm going to be the attending physician, I thought I hit the lottery. And now that it's all 2 years later, absolutely, I hit the lottery. That's my
site. Thank you, Gordon. Jessica, what was it like How did Donna and how did Gordon come into your life?
Well, first of all, I just want to remind us that I was not the only attending. There was another wonderful attending, Dr. Bhargava, who was part of the care team, who was amazing. And I was very I look back on this 2 years later, however long it's been. How long has it
been? 2 years.
2 years.
2 years.
And I just feel blessed for so many reasons to have been able to meet you. Donna was, I have to say, a very unique woman. If you've seen the movie, there are some very funny moments where Donna says some things that really show her character, that are really impressive and really strong and brave. And she made this whole experience something. She helped her family through this experience in an amazing way. And she helped me learn about how, you know, remind me how important it is to really try your best to push your way into learning what a patient really cares about and what they want. And you'll see, again, in the movie, how hard it is when someone's already on a breathing machine, which is a really important lesson to all of us about advanced care planning and how important it is to make the best plan we can, which is very hard because no one really knows how to do it before we get into extremis. But I feel very blessed to have been part of your lives and Donna's death.
You know, Jessica, you just talked about being on a breathing machine. And just to clarify, it's a machine that makes it not possible for people to speak, to use their own voice. And most people are actually not even awake enough because the machine's so uncomfortable to then communicate, say, by writing or by lip reading. Although some can, and we see in Donna's case that for periods of time, she was able to communicate herself, though you couldn't hear her voice while she's on the machine. But it starts to make you wonder, why wait if there are things that are important? And Gordon, you started us off by saying you knew what was important. The sort of the future was known in a sense that she had a very serious illness. She had seen it, you had seen it unfold in other family members, unfortunately, but you knew, and you also had clarity about how you would have wished things would go. And what do you think surprised you most about how things ultimately began to unfold?
I think my sister Donna and I were playing an inexpensive game of Go Wish at the time, sitting around the table, sitting around dinner and having a glass of wine and just talking about life and asking her kind of, so, you know, this is not getting better. So you get to have some conversations as siblings get to do. And you know, what do you want to do? And she's like, you know, can I stay here? Can I just stay here? And I was like, yeah, you can. You can stay here and we'll work it out. And we worked it out. She was no longer on support from the county. The deal was I'd keep her at home because we were afraid that if she went back to the hospital, as one of the doctors had told her in one of the previous visits, if you don't get any better, you're not going to be able to live with your brother anymore. We're going to put you, you have to go someplace. And that was frightening. But for somebody to say, can I stay? And that was it. So we mobilized friends and family, get all the things that you need, whether they're the shower seats and the commodes and the wheelchairs and a lot of donations. And you find out with a small community, you can get there. And so telling her that she could stay home, I could just see that it gave more life to her. It probably, as Dr. Zitter had explained how many years Donna lived beyond what she thought, I think that whole premise of I'm going to be able to be at home, I'm going to be able to go with dignity. And even though Donna did go to the hospital in the last weeks were very tough, she went with dignity. And a lot of that was the ICU unit at Highland Hospital. I grew up the street from Highland my entire life, born and raised in Oakland. But Highland was not our hospital. We weren't part of Highland. We were part of another healthcare. And we always knew that Highland was the county hospital, you know, the quote unquote Highland. And to think that my sister would go there and she would pass away and to be the most, probably one of the most uplifting parts, says so much about the staff at Highland and just changed just, you know, ICU units, I just, if I could just share, African-American community, we don't look at hospice. That's not part of the discussion. That's not what you go to when you go to social services. All they want to know about is you go to the hospital, bring that voucher so you can continue getting money. And that's really what's the story, and we didn't want that. So we let that lapse. We didn't want the money anymore. We didn't need that if we could take care of Donna. And obviously, I didn't know how sick she was at the time, or I probably would have went out and started the conversation about hospice. But as we've done with our grandparents and brothers and sisters and family members, and a lot of, as our country is as diverse as it is now, the conversation doesn't always penetrate down into the home. So it had not come to us yet that hospice was available at any point. And to be honest, I don't know what hospice would have done. All I know is the experience at Highland, I would do it again. I'd do it again.
You know, that reminds me when we were playing Go Wish just a little while ago with the live audience here, that someone talked about how they had a prior opinion about absolutely never wanting to die in the hospital, and yet as they thought about it, it echoes what you just said, Gordon, that maybe it's not necessarily the worst thing and to be flexible. But I wonder, Jessica, because Extremist also shows other people's experiences, and it also shows the experience from a doctor's perspective of when there isn't family to speak. So not only if a patient has lost the ability to communicate directly, but when there's still even no family, and what's that like for you?
Well, you know, first of all, I obviously feel tremendously lucky that I met Gordon and Donna, but I would say to you that I would hope that you wouldn't do that again. I would hope that you would, going forward, if God forbid this were the case with some other family member or something, and which for all of us it will be at some point, that you won't have to go to an intensive care unit in a situation where clearly someone is coming to the end of their life, because I don't think that intensive care units are the best place for patients with that kind of situation.
I agree.
Think we were lucky that we could take Donna off of that end-of-life conveyor belt, which is something I talk about a lot, where, you know, we just keep going along this default path of increasing mechanization and attaching machines. And it's just something we do because it's what we've been trained to do as doctors. And that's not what Donna wanted, but it's such a freight train. It's so hard to turn off. And luckily, we were able to do that with Donna. But I think the ICU is a very risky place for patients who are dying and who know, like Donna did, that she did not want to die in a machine. So I am thrilled that I got to meet you, but I don't want you to end up in an ICU in that kind of situation again, because it's not the right place for you.
I agree. But could I just say that the advocacy that was going on, and maybe that's the part I'm talking about, the advocacy that was going on between the nurses, the staff, and the doctors is something that you hope that that's the type of love and care and comfort and support that someone could get after a life that you've had.
Yeah,
so if I could couch it that way.
No, and to be clear, and I really appreciate that distinction, is what this participant was talking about is the care that's available when we are able to advocate what we want and how we want it, as opposed to being shooed on to this conveyor belt that you're mentioning. So I want to remind those of our listeners from home that you are listening to 91.7 KALW, and this is a live audience broadcast of Dying to Talk Radio, and we're recording in a beautiful office space in San Mateo with our generous hosts from Mission Hospice and Home Care. So I asked you a question, Jessica, that I know. That's okay, but I'm going to ask it again. So, you know, one of the things that shows up in Extreme Measures in your book, and it's something that is portrayed not as explicitly in the movie, though, is this sense of abandonment that can happen to people when they have not been able to advocate for themselves, or they don't have family members or friends or a community showing up. And even when they do, how maybe they don't necessarily have the sense that they can voice their wishes. And so what happens, and I was hoping you could talk about that from your perspective as an ICU physician.
It's very common to see people become voiceless, particularly in that kind of environment. And whether it's because they have no one else to speak for them and we're sort of playing a guessing game, or because, honestly, there's just a lack of understanding that you can be a part of directing the course of your care. People don't necessarily realize that. And so I think a lot of patients really end up dying, we have lots of data to support this, in ways that we know people don't want to die, which is alone, in a, you know, attached to machines, in pain, without their family around. And so that in and of itself is an abandonment. It's not what people want, and it's happening too frequently. And so I see it a lot, and I feel that in a way it's sort of almost an issue of justice that we need to provide every single person and family member with the information that's not yet flowing quickly and easily enough to people so that they can really take hold of dying the way that they want and not feeling abandoned.
Absolutely. And you know, Gordon, you did say something about how, speaking from an African-American community, you know, hospice is not part of the conversation. The support that is available with hospice as we sit here in Mission Hospice's office is extraordinary, and yet that was not something that you felt would even become available to you, something that was offered to you proactively, even though we knew, medically speaking, you know, what Donna's future held at some point, right? And now you've shared with me separately how, because of your experience with healthcare and your own experience in communicating with your family, that conversation has shifted with your comfort of continuing to advocate. I wondered if you could share a little bit about what that's like.
Sure. I think the conversation started in the ICU unit as family members came, as my own son and daughter came in, and then in the cafeteria there at Highland, I'm saying, okay, so if this ever happens and I'm ever in this situation, I do not want to be that way. Do not do that to me. There's things we can do. You can see, you could search out there, you find a way that I don't have to come to the hospital. And I think that is because now that in discussions really with you, Dr. Gross, and with Dr. Zitter and others, there's a lot more out there in the health community that we're aware of. And sometimes the conversations with the doctor or the nurse is maybe the humanistic touch is not there. And so you don't get it doesn't penetrate, it doesn't reach. So you do what you think is the best that you can do out there. But now knowing, you know, not just, you know, we're here at Mission Hospice, it's not just here, it's hospice as a whole and what that can do for you and what that can do for the family. Mm-hmm. When we were playing the game, you know, we talked a little bit, and I talked a little bit about the patient's responsibility. Mm-hmm. There's a patient responsibility as much as the doctors and the nurses and the staffs or caregivers, but what about the patient in helping to take care of the caregiver? Talked a little bit about humor in the back and how that can kind of take some of that edge off there, but just the how we kind of interwove ourselves and interconnect is so, so important.
No, it's really palpable in the film how connected you and Donna are, and there are many poignant moments. There's a particular poignant moment where you really promise her, I'm going to do right by you.
Yes, that's the kitchen table talk. That's a kitchen table talk when, can I do this? Is it okay? I'm sorry. A lot of in the beginning, even before you get there, or what might happen mm-hmm. there, and really going into waters that we didn't know about at the time. But I think anyone who loves and has love in their heart can look to somebody and be compassionate and say, there's a better way. If the hospital is not what you want, then let's try and find a better way. And if it had all played out the way it did, I really would have hoped that as I saw Donna decline even more, that we had went to hospice so she could have gotten what she really wanted, was to stay at home. Mm-hmm. But I really think in her mind, when you've done as much as you can, sometimes a patient needs to say, I need to let the family off the hook also. Mm-hmm. And let's go do this the right way. Now, luckily, Donna was able to get everything she wanted. And Dr. Zitter helped, but there was that moment when you have to make a decision to let someone go, and You know, yeah, I needed her to know and trust me, and I also wanted to make sure that I was trusting her, and this was a decision that she wanted, and it wasn't just because she was in a medical induced state of any, that she was clear thinking, and this is really truly what she wanted, and it was, and that was the best part of it, was she got what she wanted.
Yeah, so what you've just heard Gordon share is sort of textbook quality of what it means to be a surrogate decision maker, right? So Gordon Kaufman, featured in Extremis, at the end of his sister's life, Donna, advocating for her, in her words, in her wishes, not necessarily what you would have wanted or what other family would have wanted for her or for yourselves if you were in that position, but really honoring what she said. And Dr. Jessica Zitter here, you know, acting as one of the ICU medical team members, you know, how many times do you get put in a position where you do have family who can potentially act as a surrogate decision maker for someone who hasn't communicated their wishes as clearly as Donna, or even if they have, are they speaking for that person the way that Gordon clearly has, or is something else happening? And what do you do then?
Well, you know, one of the first things that you said to me when I, wasn't when I first met you, but it was after we started having real honest conversation about the fact that even though you say I was, you didn't realize she was actually dying. And we started talking about the fact that Donna's dying. Donna's probably never going to come out of the hospital. And it was just so surprising. And you said to me, you know, she's not looking at me. She's angry at me. She will not look in my eyes. Do you remember that?
Yes, I do. Very much.
And you were filled with a lot of guilt. You were really struggling because the trach was the plan, right? You were going to get a trach, and she was on the list for a trach.
So a trach, just to be clear, that's okay. No, go for it.
A trach is a permanent surgical connection to a machine that instead of keeping the temporary tube that goes in through the mouth down into the lungs, we transition it over to a permanent tube that goes through the neck. And she was on the list for it. And you thought, rightly so, as a loving, loving family member, brother, the closest person in her life, that this was going to help. It was going to make her more comfortable. It was going to make her mouth more comfortable. She would be able to clean her mouth. And so there was this feeling of, she's mad at me. She doesn't even want to look at me. She told me she doesn't want to be on a breathing machine. But this has been offered. And it seems like it's going to help her in some ways. And so what is a loving family member to do? And your struggle, and then you demonstrated what I thought was profound bravery in being able to, there were family members who didn't agree. And you said, you thought, you processed, and you thought about it. You talked to Donna, you see it in the movie. And then you stood up and you said, no, this is what Donna wants. And you stood strong against, not against, but putting this perspective into this conversation with your family, which is very hard to do, because when you think about it, if one person flies in from the coast, the person who flew in from the coast is what I jokingly call that concept, but somebody comes in and says, oh no, we've got to do everything, then even if there is somebody who's trying to pursue the goals of care that might actually for that particular patient be to allow them to have a natural death, you feel like a bad guy, and it's really brave. It's amazingly brave to be able to stand up and say, no, let's keep talking. I don't think this is what she wants. It's very hard, and you did it, and I was amazed by it.
Kind of like that low-hanging fruit, and you go to a hospital, and if a doctor will give you something that you can grab, it sounds great, appetizing, palatable, you'll grab it. You'll hold on to it. But the discussion of, you know, Donna's reached the end of her run, and not in front of her, just kind of off to the side, and, you know, just sharing the truth was just a real awakening for me. And you're absolutely right. It was, she didn't want the ventilator. She didn't want any of that. But I thought that a trach or something, once again, it's the low-hanging fruit that you want to sustain life. But once you hear she's dying, and it just kind of broke and shattered everything that you want to hope and perpetuate, that we can just keep this going. The doctors have to have something else, right? It's got to be TV. I share.
I was just going to say.
Dr. Gross, they laugh at me.
Grey's Anatomy.
They laugh at me because I told them the other night, you know, it's like everybody expects TV. In 30 minutes, someone's going to come around the corner. They've got a new drug. There's a new procedure. There's a new test for you to try. We're going to try it on your loved one. And you know what? Something great is going to happen. And none of that was coming. But what was coming was there's a lot of things we can do. There's a lot of dignity that we can show Donna. And that's really what I wanted. It, after a while, I didn't feel like we were going to the ICU. We were going to talk to her doctor, and we were going to talk about her. And every day, we're going to go to the hospital and talk about Donna. And what a change. I was no longer going to Highland, to the ICU unit. And Donna had a doctor. She had a doctor who cared. And Monica Bergara, another doctor, cared, and then nurses cared, and oh my God, all of a sudden, it's everything you want. So you're right, from going to the, okay, this is what Donna wanted, and I don't quite know what she wants, and then there's a whole staff around that tells you that you are on the right track.
And I think what you're pointing to, Gordon, is, you know, to be clear, I think it's safe to say just about every medical professional, doctor, nurse, respiratory therapist, medical interpreter, health aide, you name it. Anyone who's dedicated their life to be in the medical profession cares about the people they get to take care of. And yet, something happens in our healthcare system now more than ever, it seems, where that care becomes constrained in the ways that it can be expressed, in the ways that we believe, well, if they really care about me, they're going to offer X, Y, and Z. And we as medical professionals say, well, this is how I'm going to show them I care. I'm going to come up with X, Y, and Z to offer them. And Gordon, what you talk about is something different. And Jessica, given that you practice actually both, one of the most extreme versions of let me give you X, Y, and Z in critical medicine and palliative medicine, which is devoted to always taking a step back and embracing the whole person and their whole community and saying, how do we integrate all of this in their lives? What is that like for you to straddle that and bring your colleagues, bring your team members into what Gordon and his family got to experience?
Good question. it's really hard straddling anything in life. It's hard to be nuanced. It's hard to be reflective. It's much easier to just go down a path, down a protocol. And Donna was on the schedule to get a trach. It was hard to get her off the schedule emotionally. There was a lot of people to bring along. There was a lot of conversation that needed to happen. And honestly, it's a lot easier to just say, oh, schedule, she's on the schedule, let's just do it. It's hard. It takes collaboration, certainly with patient and family, and that takes tons of time. And a lot of times families have very emotional responses, which we doctors are not necessarily programmed to manage. Anger, grief, things that take time to address, and we don't have time. So in the situation with Donna, I happened to not be the direct ICU. I was one of the ICU doctors, but I wasn't responsible for the other, you know, 9 patients on the team. So I had more time to give to Donna. We were making the movie, so I was there more in that capacity. So I had more time to talk. But the reality is the typical ICU doctor doesn't have that kind of time. So when you think about it, it's just easier to go along with this, what I call, again, end-of-life conveyor belt, where, well, she's on the schedule for a trach, let's just do it, and then we'll figure it out later. And the problem is the later includes a lot of suffering that patient may never have wanted.
So I promised we would talk about life after the movie. You know, where we get left off, we get told what happens to some degree, but it's not the whole story. It doesn't really convey what life has been like 2 years since, both what's been hard as well as what's been unexpectedly profound. And I wonder if you might share a bit.
Absolutely. The difficult part is the memories. The difficult part is hoping or maybe even sometimes second-guessing yourself. Is there something else you could have done? Could you have done more? As an untrained caregiver, did I do everything I could have done? and talking to my brother a couple nights ago just about things and kind of replaying in your mind that you go through, yeah, that's the difficult part. But did we give her the best opportunity to fulfill what she wanted? I think we did. And so from there is the joy that comes out. No way in the world did my family think that Donna was even going to be in the film. I lost touch. Dr. Zitter reached through Facebook and found my daughter and was communicating. They were talking back and forth for weeks. And then my daughter finally called and says, hey, Dad, you feel like talking to Dr. Zitter? And she hasn't known. And I was like, absolutely. So for Donna's story to be part of a film, for us to talk about it, I'm at the gas station. I was in the taking Lyft over here today, and I'm telling the driver about it. And he's like, what? Really? I'm like, you know how much power you have? Do you know how much say-so you have up to the last second? But we let all that go. We watch TV, and you're going to sit back, and something dramatic's going to happen, and you'll be in the hospital. And you know what? That's all. The discussions just keep going on and on. So unfortunately, if I meet somebody around Christmas time, or I talk about it probably more than I should, and I think people look at me all the time. But yeah, I think I believe I've come over the line. I've come over the line. I'm an advocate.
So we're talking here with Gordon Kaufman, one of the family members featured in the short documentary film Extremis, which was nominated for an Oscar this past season, and Dr. Jessica Nudick Zitter, who is one of the intensive care physicians featured in the film and who helped navigate this story that unfolds between Gordon and his sister, Donna. And I'm going to take a question here from one of our live audience members. You have a question for Gordon and Jessica?
Yes, I am live. Thank you very, very much for your profound comments. I was struck by something you said, Dr. Zitter, about Donna helped her family through the experience. And I wonder if you could please address that a little bit, unpack that a little bit more. Let us know what you observed and how she talked to them. And for you, Gordon, as well, how that was for you. Thank you.
That's a great question. I think, you know, first of all, let's start with step number one, which is what Dawn has been working with you all to do today, which is advanced care planning. I mean, the fact that Donna and Gordon could actually sit down and have these incredible conversations that very few of us actually do to really be descriptive about what is okay and what isn't okay. To engage in that kind of conversation takes a certain amount of bravery. It's one thing when you have Dawn teaching you how to do it and it's, you know, and you're not sick and you don't have but that I think took bravery and was a gift really to Gordon, because if they hadn't had those conversations, and I'm sure Gordon, you're a big part of those conversations too, if they hadn't had those conversations, Gordon would have been left standing at the bedside, which I see all the time, just saying, I don't know what she cared about and what she wanted. But he knew because she had had these conversations with him. And that, to me, is one step of incredible bravery and a gift that you can give your families, having advanced care planning. And the second was, again, I don't know if you see the movie, you'll see. You watch it. It's beautiful at one point when she gets extubated. And there's been conversation. Everybody's anxious and stressing and trying to figure it out. And we're using letter charts and trying to get her to spell things for us. And it's beautifully captured. Dan Krause did an amazing job. You see her mouth move. You can barely hear her because she can't speak very loud. She says, tell everybody to calm down. It's beautiful. And I mean, that to me, again, is another gift. She was calm in the presence of her own impending death. And that was beautiful.
And while she sang that, we're all hugging each other, giving each other high fives. And that was the calm down, because we're just an exuberant. We're just, this euphoria is going on in the room because it's a huge step for us. And now she's back in control.
Yeah.
Getting off the ventilator gave the 100% power back in Donna's hands. And even if it was only for a brief moment, it was there.
How many hours? It was about 36 hours, or was it 24 hours? She lived for, I know she had,
she lived,
it was the next day.
She lived as the next day. She lived for about 24 hours.
24 more hours.
Living, breathing on her own. And it was probably some of the best 24 hours that you can get, to know that you've come that far, your race is run, You're going to put your head down for the last time, and you know you ran a good race. And that one breath was, yeah, we went home that night knowing that, because Dr. Zitter had told us she's probably only going to live. You're very honest. You know, I know you were trying to say, I hope that it'll be a long time, but then she put her hat on, her doctor's hat on, and says, you know what, it's probably going to be a day or two. But that night, probably one of the most relaxing nights for me in a long time, because we had achieved where we wanted to go.
Isn't it true that she died when George was brushing her hair?
Yes, my brother was there. All the things you want, people stroking you, touching you, your hair being brushed, laughing, holding Mardi Gras beads. You know, we tried to create the scene. And a lot of that had to do with the staff. You know, what was she like? What did she want?
Right. I'm going to correct you since we played Go Wish, Gordon.
Okay.
It's all the things Donna wanted.
All the things. Very true.
Right?
Very true.
I'm not sure everyone here wants to hold Mardi Gras beads. I don't want to assume that. But Donna did.
Donna
knew that.
Donna did. And the discussion, I think, on the question of how did she really help, she took a lot of ownership off of our shoulders. And she put it all back on hers. In every conversation, when Dr. Zitter, Dr. Bergara, any of the attendees would come in, and Donna had done something off the letter chart, that once again, she had made a decision. She made so many decisions in the time that she was strapped and was on a ventilator. It was just powerful there.
So we have another audience member who is live who's going to ask a question.
Dr. Zitter, would things have played out differently? What would have been the scenario if she had had an advanced health care directive or a pulsed form?
So let's just define those two things before you answer. Great question.
Great question. Thank you so much. An advanced health care directive is a document that allows you to choose a surrogate decision maker, which is notarized. If they're done correctly, it needs to be notarized, which is legally binding, so that person can speak for you. And it also has a sort of a very general, what's called a healthcare directive, instruction directive, which means, do you want to be kept alive even if your quality of life isn't going to be acceptable to you, or do you want us to allow you to die naturally? And I think that's a very important question for all of us to answer, but it's, number one, not legally binding, so it's just a checkbox. And number two, what quality of life means to one person is very different from what it might mean to another. So it's not that helpful in terms of, for the ICU physician, getting an instruction about what should I do right now, because I don't know what's important. What is worth us continuing to keep this person on life-prolonging treatments, because I don't know that person. A pulsed form, physician order for life-sustaining treatment, is a physician's order. It's an order. So it's very simple. Do not intubate, or yes, intubate. You wouldn't fill it out if yes, because that's the default, and we do it for everybody. But the people who fill out pulsed forms are people who say, I do not want to be intubated. I do not want to receive CPR.
You can fill it out so that it says to intubate.
Course,
I mean,
absolutely.
Just so people are clear, that you always have the choice and you can articulate
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. But had we had a pulsed, and probably this would have been, I mean, this was a failure in the system, because Donna knew she didn't want to be intubated. Donna knew she didn't want to live on machines. She probably should have had a pulsed form. She should have had a pulse form that said, do not intubate. That way she would have, as she started to go into respiratory failure, she would never have come in. I know you wanted to be in the ICU, but it would have been better had she never come into the ICU, because she was getting on the verge of getting a trach. And that is a very hard thing to emotionally just disconnect a person from. So a pulse would have been probably appropriate in this situation, but very few people even know what it is. So
I have
another question from the audience here.
Yes. I have a question. I need some clarification. I do have a health directive where it says do not resuscitate. So is that another form that I need that called pulse?
Okay.
I'm not sure.
Well, since this is a podcast and people can't see you, I want to make a point, which I think is really, really interesting and important. You're a young, very healthy-looking, very functionally active person. And it's very interesting to me. I know a lot of people who say, I do not want to end up in an ICU. I do not want to end up on machines. But I'm always fascinated about people who feel that way, because for me, the ICU still has a tremendous amount to offer. So I'm curious to ask you, actually, what are you saying that there's no circumstance under which you would want to be resuscitated in any way, even if you could go back to the quality of life that you're living right now?
All right, this is a first. Okay. We're having a dialogue with audience. I love it. All right.
But last part, if my quality of life is going to be diminished, do not resuscitate.
Okay.
If my life is going to go back to where I was being okay, then yes.
Perfect.
Perfect. So yeah. Does that need to be clarified in my
Very much. Report? You would not fill out a pulse form right now. No. No, no, no. Because for you, every intervention in an intensive care unit, until we figured out what your quality of, I would assume that any reason you would be in an intensive care unit would probably be trauma or something that acutely happened. It's different for someone with chronic illness that's progressively worsening, like myotonic dystrophy, where there's a progressive worsening. But in somebody who has an acute cause of deterioration that would require, that would incite people to put you on life prolonging treatments, it takes us a little bit of time to figure out what your quality of life is going to be. So the first response, I think you're saying, would be appropriate to put you on life support and then figure out what's your quality of life going to be and then have a conversation. But you look like you're skeptical.
Wait. I did my health directive quite a bit ago. It's like I'm trying to remember the paragraph. I think I did write in there, if my quality of life is drastically different.
Right.
So I think the words matter how that is phrased, right?
So that's exactly where I'm going to say that's why we played Go Wish. That's why you keep playing Go Wish, because I don't know what quality of life is. When you say until quality of life is no longer... As a doctor, and this was my question for you, Jessica, if Donna came in and didn't have Gordon, didn't know these conversations of what her wishes were, had maybe an advanced directive like you're describing, do this until my quality of life is diminished, what would an ICU doctor who knows nothing else about the person do?
Okay. So in the case of Donna, I was doing everything I can, I think this was before I met Gordon, to try, I was using the letter chart, and I was trying to communicate with her and get a sense of what her quality of life, what was important to her quality of life-wise, because she was about to get a trach, and I knew she had a chronic disease that was continuing to deteriorate, so in my mind, the likelihood was that if she got trached, she would be on a ventilator permanently. And I wanted, most people wouldn't want that. That's we just know that. Most people would not want that. So I feel that we have an obligation to make sure before we default into doing a trach that she understands that that's a risk, that that's a very high risk, that Donna Kaufman, who has this very serious disease, is very likely, if she gets trached, to be in a ventilator facility for the rest of her life. If that's okay with her, by all means, let's proceed with the trach. But we hadn't given her that information. She didn't understand that. I don't think that this was a really high chance of that being an outcome. And so
I think one of the challenges we often see in the hospital and in the extreme cases in the intensive care unit is that vague place where medicine does not have the crystal ball.
Right.
I don't know how it's going to go, and I don't know how it will impact an individual's quality of life.
But the basic and most concrete answer is yes. If I couldn't have gotten information out of Donna, and if there was no Gordon and history of what she had said, she would have gotten trached.
Okay.
Yeah.
And because there was nothing.
Yeah. Nothing had been written down. There was no pulse saying do not
intervene. Donna did not have anything written down. You were her.
Which is very common.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very common. Okay.
Yeah.
We have another question from a live audience studio.
And my question is related to what we were just speaking of. So it means that most people, as you said, would not want a trach. But that is what happens automatically if wishes aren't told. And is that because even though most people don't want it, their family wants it? Is that why that's the status
quo? Well, we were using the example of somebody for whom it wasn't an issue of family. It was an issue of, I just don't know, and I can't get the information from the patient. Sometimes it's an issue of the family saying, yes, we have to keep this person alive, which was the other patient in the movie, by the way. We have to keep this person alive. That's what we want to do. And it may go against what I would want to do for myself, but that was, we sometimes are dictated by family members, and sometimes we're dictated by just not knowing. It is the default to keep a body alive. That's the default. I mean, because who really feels comfortable making that decision? If I had taken the tube out, as we saw, Donna died. And if we had put her on a trach, she probably would have lived in this vent facility quality of life, which wouldn't have been acceptable to her, for maybe days, maybe weeks, who knows. And who wants to take that personal responsibility of saying, no, you know what, I'm deciding to take that tube out and she's going to die today or tomorrow. It's a lot to ask of a doctor.
It's a lot. And I think in our culture in America, we have a real preponderance of putting the priority on autonomy, as opposed to in some other cultures, there's a priority on the societal good or on paternalistic approach to medicine. So I think we're speaking about what American healthcare looks like today.
Yeah. And Gordon wants to say something, but I just want to say what we do, I think, incorrectly, unfortunately, but it's just the way we do it, is we associate, we equate autonomy with life prolongation. That's right. We think that's the correlation right there. Yeah.
We have another question from an audience member.
You said at the beginning of the talk that Donna wanted to die at home, and I'm just wondering why that was not able to happen.
Donna lived with me for approximately 5 years, and she continued to decline from the myotonic dystrophy. We had the agreement, everything was fine, go to work and prepare meals, and life was going on. She was still able to move around our apartment where we lived. And then I came home one day, and she said, my legs are numb. And I'm like, what do you mean? She says, I can't walk. I've been stuck. So I'm like, well, give it 24 hours, and let's see. Maybe it'll come back. Maybe it was just a little numbness or something. It didn't come back. So the next day, I was like, okay, now we got to go to the hospital. And I think she had resigned herself. She knew. Dr. Zitter had given me all the stats on really where Donna's condition was at that time. I took her to the hospital, and our agreement was, I'm going to take you. Let's see what they say. I'm going to bring you home unless they won't let you come home. If they won't let you come home, then you're going to have to go to a care facility. But as soon as you can come home, I will bring you home, even if we have to have somebody come live with us. I'll do that for you. So that was the discussion, and that was the plan. But one day, she had I call it an acute attack. Her legs just went paralyzed, and that started the ball. And that's the reason why we went to Highland. I would have stayed, let her stay at home to the absolutely end. And I had shared that and our family knew. But once again, there's some things I'm not trained for. There's no way I could have went over that hump. But it was our intent to bring her back.
Absolutely.
And I think that points to one of the gaps in our healthcare system and why this specialty of palliative medicine has come into existence, which is to try and provide a path to helping people stay in the lives and in the way they've known themselves that matters most to them all the way through their life until their last breath. And hospice is palliative care, but it's the way that it's designed is specifically for the last 6 months of life. And the truth is, none of us know when that is. I mean, that's exactly what you're painting, Gordon. We knew that her life was going to be limited, and we knew she was getting sicker, but we never knew exactly when. And when these moments were happening, there was nothing available to him that he was aware of and that could come in and help them stay at home. It exists, but not nearly as robustly as the hospital. And we know how to do that. We know how to access that healthcare and healthcare facilities, but we don't know about, or we don't have the resources quite yet to make hospice available to everyone beyond those 6 months, which is what palliative care is, and to make it available in the home. So we have a lot of work to do. It's a little plug for you all, some advocacy as we redesign healthcare.
The end of life conveyor belt, you get in there and you think you're gonna just come right back out and you just get sucked along.
Can I ask a question to the two of you?
Is
that possible,
question.
A live question?
Absolutely.
Let's say I was not there at the hospital. Like, other patients in the ICU unit on both sides of Donna were at times. So what would, and I think it goes to a couple questions that came out, what would have happened to Donna, like some of the patients on both sides of me, when nobody came for days? There was patients, it's been 3 days in the ICU, and nobody has come yet. And I'm wondering, what's happening to them? Who's making the decisions? Because we're up to in our neck with making decisions. So how does that happen? What happens?
They get on the end of life conveyor belt. I hate to say that; it sounds so callous, but that's what would happen. I would be participating in that as the ICU attending. If I can't figure it out, if I can't get that information, we default to prolonging life, and that is the reality.
And that is why we're having this conversation today in honor of National Healthcare Decisions Week, and why we played Go Wish this morning, and I said it was just the beginning of a conversation that I encourage all of us to have again and again and again, that even the best laid plans, life happens. And we need to find the ways to communicate what our life means to us now while we're well, so we can do our best to make sure the people around us can advocate for us, support us, and do that, and not then be burdened with wondering, did we do it right? Gordon is really lucky. He knows he did it right. Yeah. I want to thank our guest this hour, Dr. Jessica Nudig-Zitter, physician and author of Extreme Measures, Finding a Better Path to the End of Life, and featured in the Oscar-nominated short documentary Extremis, along with our guest, Gordon Kaufman, exemplar surrogate decision maker. If I had a badge, if I had a trophy, and all the generous souls that surrounded you and supported you in that incredibly difficult time. Thank you both for being the conveyors of such poignant and personal stories, offering each of us a better path to the end of life. And thanks to all of you in our audience here. Let's hear it, audience. For joining us live at Mission Hospice and Home Care in San Mateo, with a special thanks to Susan Barber, Manager of Community Education at Mission Hospice and Home Care, and the Mission Hospice volunteers, Wendy Ellis, Kathy Geiser, and Ernie Roeder, whose generosity and spirit infuses this space, creating an entirely new context for the Bay Area to learn about and engage with the mission of hospice, pun intended, and caring for an entire person in their community so we may all live the fullest, most gracious life through our final exhale. This special program of Dying to Talk is produced by KALW at the Office of Mission Hospice and Home Care in San Mateo. Matt Martin is our on-site and advising producer, and Chris Locius has been our recording engineer, and special thanks to Richard Barley for supporting this program. All of the music to Dying to Talk is by the Oakland-based band, The Kilbanes. And if you can't wait to share this program, this and all the other previous Dying to Talk programs, as well as the resources related to what we've talked about, including how to play Go Wish, can be found on the Dying to Talk webpage at kalw.org. I'm Dr. Dawn Gross, inviting you to be curious, ask questions, and never settle. Or, as a hospice patient once taught me, life is uncertain. Better eat dessert first.